We have a lot of very distinguished but possibly long-winded judges here in this last panel, so I think let's try to get started. They've all promised to behave, but who's going to try and enforce it? Not me, certainly. This question of textual interpretation and original intent that we've been talking about all day is not one that arises only in the law. I'd just like to give you one example from my own profession, which is journalism. A few years ago, I got a call, much to my astonishment, from the Honorable Arthur Goldberg. This was at a time of one of the perennial disputes about the meaning of UN Resolution 242, which ended the 1967 war in the Middle East. Justice Goldberg had been a UN ambassador at that time, and he says, "I would like to write an article about the true meaning of UN Resolution 242. I wrote it, therefore I'm the only person who knows what it really means." And I said to him, "Well, if you wrote it, why couldn't you have written it so that other people would know what it really means?" And that did solve my problem with Justice Goldberg, which was, of course, my original intent. He didn't bother me anymore. And it's unfortunate we can't solve these constitutional problems so easily. Now, the specific question of this panel is phrased, I thought, rather tendentiously as the conflict between text and precedent in constitutional adjudication, which of course implies that there is a conflict between the text and the precedents that are bothering people the most. I would rephrase it in, I think, a more balanced and judicious way as, if conservatives get a majority on the Supreme Court, should they feel free to overrule all the doctrines that have been bothering them for the past two or three decades? Or should they feel constrained by some of these very noble considerations about predictability and that we have been discussing in terms of the classical law today? Now, as it happens, I wrote a letter to Judge Easterbrook asking him to write an article on this very question just a year ago, and I'd just like to read a bit from this letter. "Dear Judge Easterbrook," then there follow a couple of boilerplate flattery paragraphs, and which I will leave out. Here's the nugget. "On the one hand, surely, constitutional doctrine should not be a simple matter of counting up the votes at any given moment. On the other hand, equally surely, we should not be stuck for all time with Plessy versus Ferguson. So if the proper standard is something in between, what is it? Lawyers and judges, of course, have some standard techniques for undermining precedents while pretending to honor them. But of course, you would never do such a thing yourself. So what is the answer? Et cetera, et cetera." Judge Easterbrook wisely declined this opportunity to publicly expose his views on this subject, but I have him trapped here today, along with two other federal judges, a Yale professor and a high Justice Department official, so I think they won't be able to escape so easily. As we say in my profession, this is all on the record. As you say in your profession, anything you say can be used against you. I'm going to introduce our panelists in reverse order, just for a change of pace. Judge Stephen Reinhardt is on the Ninth Circuit. He was appointed in 1980. Before that, he was in private practice and active in the Democratic Party. Judge Easterbrook, Frank Easterbrook, was appointed to the Seventh Circuit in 1985. Before that, he was a professor here at Chicago Law School. Professor Lee Brillmeyer is the Nathan Baker Professor of Law at Yale Law School. And before that, she was here also on the faculty at Chicago. Judge Patrick Higginbotham was appointed to the Fifth Circuit in 1982, and he was a district court judge before that and in private practice before that. And Chuck Cooper is Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel. Before that, he was a Deputy Assistant Attorney General, and I guess before that, he was in junior high school. General Cooper.
I skipped junior high school, Mike. I am entirely content with your reformulation of today's topic, but let me say this at the outset. It is high time that the Federalist Society has devoted a panel at a national symposium to the doctrine of constitutional stare decisis. For if there's any principle that is fundamental to the true conservative, if there's any doctrine that is inviolable to the true conservative, if there is any rule that is cardinal to the true conservative, it is stare decisis. Now, if you do not believe me, ask any true liberal. Or for those of you who subscribe to the Washington Post, ask any true moderate. Isn't it amusing that liberals who only recently have perceived the profound value of stability of the law have taken to lecturing conservatives on what it takes to be a true conservative? Listen to Alan Dershowitz of Harvard. As he explained during the 1984 presidential campaign, truly conservative justices will abide by notions of stare decisis, and they will not move in to simply count the votes and try to overrule a prior decision. But if you vote for Ronald Reagan, he warned, Mr. Meese will appoint judges who are essentially sworn to a program of reversing certain Supreme Court decisions, something the liberals have never done. Perish the thought. The truth, of course, is that stare decisis has always been a doctrine of convenience to both conservatives and liberals. Its friends, for the most part, are determined by the needs of the moment. Justice Douglas, writing in 1949, candidly described the phenomenon. Today's new and startling decision, he said, quickly becomes a new coveted anchorage for new vested interests. The former proponents of change acquire an acute conservatism in their new status quo. It will then take an oncoming group of a new generation to catch the broader vision, which may require an undoing of the work of our present and their past. Justice Douglas, of course, was describing the conflict between the Lochner-era court and the court of which he was then a member. But his observations, it seems to me, are equally applicable to describe today's rush to embrace constitutional stare decisis by those who, but a short time ago, thrilled to the sight of the Warren Court engaging in the judicial equivalent of strip mining. Now, it will not surprise you to learn that I agree with Justice Robert Jackson, who, when a lowly assistant attorney general, said that the judge who can take refuge in a precedent does not need to reason. Or, as Justice Douglas put it in his 1949 speech, such a judge lets men long dead do his thinking for him. I think that the doctrine of stare decisis, in the context of written law, suffers from two insurmountable weaknesses. First, it is inherently subjective, and Supreme Court justices, with only the rarest, if any, exceptions, cannot resist the natural temptation to manipulate it. Second, and more fundamentally, its avowed office is to shelter error from correction. Now, both of these deficiencies were on display in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Johnson v. Santa Clara Transportation Agency. It's very recent. Some of you may not have read it, so let me describe it. In Johnson, a male plaintiff argued, one, that he had been denied a promotion because of his sex, and two, that Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act was intended by Congress to prohibit such discrimination. Five justices of the Supreme Court agreed. That is, they agreed that Mr. Johnson had been passed over because of his sex, and that Title VII was intended to ban just that discrimination. Yet a majority of the Supreme Court nonetheless denied him relief, as well as countless other people who were intended to be beneficiaries of the protection of the statute. Now, this candid judicial repealer of a duly enacted congressional statute came about because two of the five justices who believed that Mr. Johnson was entitled to relief under Title VII invoked the doctrine of stare decisis. Justices Stevens and O'Connor couldn't bring themselves to join Justice Brennan's plurality opinion, but joined the result because they didn't want to overrule the Weber decision. Now, Weber, you will recall, held that the racially discriminatory exclusion of a white male from a craft training program is not prohibited by the provision of Title VII that provides as follows. It shall be unlawful for an employer to discriminate against any individual with respect to his terms, conditions, or privileges of employment because of such individual's race. Now let's take just a moment to examine Justice Stevens' discussion of stare decisis, for it is an extraordinary example of the extent to which the doctrine can be manipulated by the determined judge. Incidentally, while the Johnson case raises the stare decisis issue in a statutory context rather than a constitutional context, and I am aware of the correct title of today's event, I believe that the points to be made are equally applicable in either context. Justice Stevens defined the issue thus: the only problem for me is whether to adhere to an authoritative construction of the act, the Weber case, that is at odds with my understanding of the actual intent of the authors of the legislation. Noting the undoubted public interest in stability and orderly development of the law, Justice Stevens decided to adhere to Weber because, one, it had been decided, which hardly seems to distinguish it from any other precedent, and two, it was, as he put it, now an important part of the fabric of our law. For his standard, Justice Stevens borrowed from Cardozo's book, The Nature of the Judicial Process, wherein it is said, if judges have woefully misinterpreted the mores of their day, or if the mores of their day are no longer those of ours, they ought not to tie in helpless submission the hands of their successors. Justice Stevens' reliance on this passage candidly forces one to suspect, reluctantly to be sure, that he didn't get around to reading the whole book. For if he had, he surely would have noted that Cardozo was discussing the role of stare decisis in the development of the common law. After all, Cardozo made the point in 1921. When he was a justice of the New York Court of Appeals, the bulk of whose decisions dealt with the common law. And on realizing this, Justice Stevens presumably would have been compelled to ask whether the rationale underlying the operation of the doctrine of stare decisis in the common law context is any different from that in the statutory or written law context. And I think that the answer to that question is pretty obviously yes. Justice Stanley Reed, when he was Solicitor General, put it well. Stare decisis has been a guiding principle of the common law from its beginnings. However, the doctrine of stare decisis has a philosophic necessity in the common law system, which is not found elsewhere. The other systems apply a written document to the concrete controversies which come before the court. The judge who applies a section of a civil code, be it constitutional or statutory, must always measure the decisions of his predecessors against the document which they were interpreting. However high the authority of the prior decisions, they remain inferior to the law itself. Contrast this with the philosophy of the common law jurisprudence. There is no law but the judicial decisions themselves. Right or wrong, they are the law. Accordingly, the common law judge who does not follow stare decisis does more than differ with his predecessors. He quite literally changes the law. Thus, if the lawmaker, that's the end quote. Thus, if the lawmaker in the first instance is the judge, as in the common law, then the judge is free to change the law, but should do so only for reasons that outweigh the public interest in stability in the law. That the governing common law precedents are in conflict with the mores of the day, Cardozo thought, as do I, is sufficient reason usually to depart from the precedents. But if the lawmaker is the legislator or the framer, the judge is not free to change it. While the Supreme Court has often exercised the powers of the legislature and the framers, it has never claimed them. Let's indulge the assumption, however, that the mores of the day are somehow relevant to the issues of statutory construction, and go on. Justice Stevens next concluded that the mores of the day favor adherence to rather than departure from precedent. Now, to sustain this proposition, he offers one proof, and that is that Chief Justice Berger, in his dissent in Weber, quote, observed that the result reached by the majority in that case was one that he would have been inclined to vote for were he then a member of Congress considering a proposed amendment to Title VII. Now, Chief Justice Berger is a many good things, but to my knowledge, Justice Stevens is the first to regard him as a fail-safe barometer of the mores of our day. To the contrary, if one consults something that at least purports to measure the mores of our day, let us say the public opinion polls, one finds that they consistently reflect that the American people do not like quotas, racial preferences of any kind. And in fact, 2 days after the Johnson decision was decided, a USA Today reports that its poll reflects that 63% of all women think the case was wrongly decided. So Justice Stevens' analysis reduces to this. He will cast his vote in favor of permitting sex discrimination that he believes is barred by Title VII, because a five-justice majority made a similar error in 1979 regarding race discrimination. And the error is now a part of the fabric of our law because it is in harmony with the mores of our day in 1987, which mores are clearly reflected by the fact that in 1979, Warren Berger would have voted in favor of a measure a measure permitting such discrimination had he been in Congress. Now, if anyone seeks after additional proof that Justice Stevens' decision in Johnson was driven by a result, such proof abounds. In obedience to the clock, which is up, let's examine just one comparable case. In Monell versus New York Department of Social Services, Supreme Court held that municipalities are subject to damages liability under Section 1983. In so doing, the court overruled the contrary case of Monroe against Pape, decided 17 years earlier, and followed in several subsequent cases. Justice Stevens overcame his devotion to stare decisis and voted with a majority, but he did not write separately to explain his vote. But in subsequent opinions, he has provided two justifications for his vote in Monell. Both reasons betray the inherent subjectivity and manipulability of stare decisis. First, Monroe did not qualify for stare decisis because it was, quote, egregiously incorrect. Weber, then, must be just incorrect. Not egregiously so. But the truth is that calling Weber egregiously incorrect is a fantastic understatement. It is the judicial equivalent of an Isuzu commercial. His second justification for overruling Monroe is that, I'm quoting, Congress phrased some older statutes, such as Section 1983, in sweeping general terms, expecting federal courts to interpret them on a case-by-case basis in the common law tradition. What was the sweeping general term at issue in Monell? Person. Well, let's face it, the term could mean anything. As it happens, it means cities. Now, even if Justice Stevens' application of stare decisis in Johnson was not so palpably disingenuous, it would be illegitimate for a more fundamental reason. The point was well made, and made very well, by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1786. A court is not bound to give the like judgment, which had been given by a former court, unless they are of opinion that the first judgment was according to law, for any court may err. And if a judge conceives that a judgment given by a former court is erroneous, he ought not in conscience to give the like judgment, he being sworn to judge according to law. Acting otherwise would have this consequence. Because one man has been wronged by a judicial determination, therefore every man having a like cause ought to be wronged likewise. In sum, I, along with Professor Herbert Wexler, believe that prior decisions must be subject to reexamination whenever a case against their reasoning is made. And prior decisions are entitled only to the deference that their reasoning demands. Thank you.
You gotta be kidding.
Well, I guess Coach Bryant would be proud, I suppose. I feel, first off, a little like a father of a young lawyer that he went to court with, and took the son to court, and the boy asked his dad if he could make the opening statement. He finally agreed, and the young boy got up and he opened, and he talked and he talked and talked and told the jury all that he was going to prove and all that he was going to do, and finally sat down very pleased with himself and turned to his dad and said, "Did I open?" And his dad looked at him and said, "Son, you opened, but you've opened so widely I'm not sure I can close." I'm not going to try to close. First off, giving to this panel the topic, the conflict between text and precedent and constitutional adjudication, has a generous assumption that we will find common turf on the large field it describes. At one level, the whole idea is oxymoronic in that precedent that conflict with text is simply not precedent, and I'm glad we reformulated the subject. But this only, for me, points up the difficulty of describing the role of precedent. It's an understandable difficulty because one's view of precedent, to some extent, is inevitably bound up with one's view of law itself. As language is a lawyer's tool, or as Charles Black puts it, the linseed oil of the law, it is equally understandable that the lawyer's response to the topic is inevitably, well, what is text and what is precedent? And I guess it's the disabilities of a legal education, or perhaps the absence of much more, that lead me to describe precedent with its difficulties first, and then to turn to its fit with text. Describing text engages political view because precedent is inevitably in part, sometimes in large part, in the eye of the beholder. Yet, it is my very strong conviction that the concept of precedent has force, that it has sufficient discipline to decide the great percentage of cases that come to, certainly to our court and inferior court, including constitutional issues. It is my observation that it in fact does so. That a little mysticism, priestly role-playing, and postured discovering of the law has survived the realist and the law and supporters, or even that they're yet important to the acceptance of judicial lawmaking, does not mean that the concept of precedent lacks content at its core. As Professor David Bryden put it in denying that constitutional law is all politics and no law, the difference between a partial myth and a complete myth is the difference between Abraham Lincoln and the Tooth Fairy. In defining precedent, we must distinguish among a larger set of rules that also bind successors to a decision. While these rules may incidentally serve purposes similar to the purposes of stare decisis, their primary purpose is to cope with the increasing size and output of the court and to manage the mechanics of who speaks for the court. For example, our circuit, as do many others, has a formal rule that one panel cannot overturn another, and rejection of our own precedent is for the en banc court. The circuit rule insisting that one panel cannot overrule another requires adherence regardless of how wrong-headed the panel deciding the subsequent case may believe it to be, absent an intervening decision by the Supreme Court. Relatedly, we provide by rule that a panel cannot decline to follow a decision of a sister circuit if it will create a conflict among the circuits. These rules of orderliness are similar to rules in some state appellate courts that insist that a unanimous decision can be overturned only by a unanimous court. I leave to devotees of games theory the exploration of how such rules can affect outcomes. For now, I simply want to lay aside those rules. Next, I think we ought to keep in mind that the bind of first decision differs in its horizontal and vertical reaches. District judges do not treat decisions of other district judges as binding, and apart from conflict-reducing rules, circuit courts do not treat decisions of sister courts as binding. In talking about precedent, I am then talking about how the Supreme Court treats its own precedent and how precedent binds on its vertical reach. First, treating precedent in its common law tradition, and I emphasize that, as stare decisis, that is, to stand by decided cases and then adding to the constitutional mix constitutional text. As Roger Traynor pointed out, in modern Italian, stare means to stay, to stand, to lie, or to sit, to remain, to keep, to stop, or to wait. With delightful flexibility, it also means to depend, to fit, to suit, to live, and of course to be. As we will see, Italian may better describe some views and perhaps Chuck's view of precedent than will the Latin. The values claimed for precedent are familiar. Professor Wasserman lists four major justifications: certainty, reliance, equality, and efficiency. He lists his minor justifications: practical experience, a notion resting upon the hypothesis that judge-made law enables a system to enable itself quite readily to adapt to new situations and novel controversies by responding to those situations in an a posteriori fashion as they arise. There's little to quarrel with here as a description of abstract values in the common law decision mode. It is, of course, in the application of doctrine that strengths and weaknesses take definition. In describing the mechanics of stare decisis, it's important to keep in mind that the deciding court cannot fully control the precedential force that its decisions will have. That strength is in the main given by the successor decision maker. Of course, the first decision maker may write broadly and may even disclaim a holding, but the accepted decisional process makes this effort less than fully effective. That is, we accept that it is the rule of the case or ratio decidendi that binds, and the successor court has play, often considerable, in deciding what that holding is. As Carl Llewellyn teaches, the later court can confine the first case to its facts, concluding, for example, in such his language, this rule holds only for red-headed Walpoles in pale magenta Buick cars. A court may equally give full sway to all that was said in the earlier decision. Faced with multiple prior cases, it may simultaneously give broad and narrow readings. Stated in its happy form, it is the Janus faced, as Llewellyn called it, quality of stare decisis that allows the case method to evolve doctrine. Stated in more fearsome terms, it is a considerable source of judicial power, a power that may aptly be called the heartbeat of common law decision making. That is, the courts obedient to stare decisis have the range, at least within an outer circle of an earlier case, to push the law, often to push the law off in a quite different direction from the first court, and then never overturn the earlier decision. It is important to keep in mind that the concept of stare decisis, or doctrine if you prefer that, offers no guidance for the interpreting court's choice of whether it will give a broad or narrow reading to the first holding. The push one way or the other, in Llewellyn's terms, must come from elsewhere. Elsewhere, I will for now simply leave in the common law mode as judicial attitude. In its common law mode, its rationale are heavy reliance upon analogical reasoning or description, often leaving unidentified any regression line or guiding value. It would seem that as decisions are reached and a line of cases are developed by a succession of broad and narrow readings that the ambit of each succeeding deciding court is circumscribed. And so it may be for the intellectually honest court. But under the tradition, the deciding court's ambit of discretion is in part a function not only of its honesty, but its creative ability, or so it seems. I suggest, however, there is a baseline, and it is that point at which facile restatement of prior holdings, restatement of cases, and discovery of underlying principles becomes dissembling. But between blind mechanical adherence on the one hand and dishonest statement on the other lies a sometimes significant area that does seem to reward creative jurists with the opportunity to impose their will. Nonetheless, as courts push toward the limit of dissembling treatment of precedent, they disserve the values of stare decisis, because there is a point at which there is no predictability. Expectations become so unsettled that parties cannot adjust their affairs. Such creative jurisprudence at this point begins to raise questions about whether the law is indeed any more than judges' individual predilections. But these difficulties largely revolve around effectiveness of rules and less about power, authority of the decision maker when we're talking about common law decision making. Even there, I suggest that this occurs far less in the world of daily decisions than my academic friends suppose. Law professors are bright and creative as a group. In their teaching and scholarship, they thrive at the margin where legal doctrine's developing is uncertain and delight of delights internally inconsistent. Students barraged with Socratic slicings of these cases are given a skewed view of stare decisis and perpetuate a voguish agnosticism about law being little more than judges' predilection. But with this aside, I return to my main point, that the predictability of judicial decisions must rest in part upon some awareness of the attitudes of the judges that are reading the precedent, given the latitude of honest judges and given the latitude of stare decisis. So far, I've not spoken at all of constitutional text or focused upon the precedent force of decisions construing text. That is, critically, I have not described a system where the values are external and the force of precedent is therefore quite different, the force of stare decisis and application quite distinct. In turning to precedent constitutional text, I start with Justice Frankfurter's oft-cited statement that the ultimate touchstone of constitutionality is the Constitution itself, and not what we have said about it. Questions about the power of common law courts usually ask whether a particular decision ought to have been left for the legislature. For the most part, the lawmaking function of the common law judge is accepted on the assumption that the legislature is available to correct errors. Justice Stevens himself said in an opinion joined by Justices Brennan, Stewart, and Blackmun that the doctrine of stare decisis has a more limited application when the precedent rests on constitutional grounds, because correction through legislative action is practically impossible. This precedent has long standing. It is common to the distinction between the two. The ultimate distinction between the two becomes that when the decision maker has before him the question of whether he will give the broad or the narrow reading to the prior precedent, well, he will engage in the Janus-faced operation, to use Llewellyn's term, of applying precedent. We must find which control the judge will push. For the judge who's construing text, that answer must come from the application of what we refer to in the acronym as SIF formulation, structural inference, text and history, by reference to those, to the values that are discernible from the text of the Constitution, applying faithfully the value choices made by those writers and none other, as difficult as that task may be. Therein lies the difference, in the most abstract or in the most generally stated form, between the application of stare decisis and, on the one hand, in common law decision making, and when we turn to the Constitution. It is a doctrine which certainly can be abused and often is abused. But nonetheless, it is a doctrine that does serve well and day in and day out decides a great bulk of cases in this country.
Well, Judge Easterbrook has suggested to me that a precedent has now been established that I'm entitled to 16 minutes. I think there's also a precedent that we're entitled to stretch whatever it is that we're entitled to, so I'm going to stretch that to 25 minutes. When I was asked about being on this panel, this is not a subject that I've ever had to really confront in the way that judges confront it, because being a law professor, you don't ever have to really decide cases, and so I'd never really had to think about this very hard, but I was told by the Federalist Society that this was a great opportunity for us to get a dialogue started. We should think about these problems, and it was a very interesting thing, because the conclusion that I came to in this subject is that there's incredibly good arguments on both sides of the issue. Let me first say that there's, I think, a threshold problem before you get to the question of what you're going to do with resolving a conflict between text and precedent, and that is, are there in fact any conflicts between text and precedent? And this is not a purely facetious question, because it's possible to take the extreme positivist point of view that what the precedent says is indeed what the text means. This is not a point of view that I adopt at all, but it's jurisprudentially very interesting and not totally easy to explain what is the matter with this point of view. One piece of evidence that I would like to give that suggests that the cases that you read cannot be authoritative in the same way as the text is the highly contingent nature by which precedents are actually decided. If you sort of imagine the Supreme Court, nine justices heading into the courthouse to conduct their business one day, and there's about to be a 5-4 decision, and on the way to court, two of the conservative or two of the liberal judges happen to be run over by a bus and killed, this sort of thing might change the outcome of the decision. But it would be rather bothersome to say if the vote had been taken yesterday, then verdict for the plaintiff would have been correct. But now, since it's going to be taken today, that the judgment for the other side is going to be correct. We feel rather uncomfortable with allowing correctness to turn on that sort of thing, and yet that's the sort of coincidence that dictates so many, many judicial decisions that get actually made. It's interesting to contrast this problem with how we would feel if this was legislation or a constitution. If on the way to the Constitutional Convention, several people were run over by a bus and didn't make it to the vote, and so the vote went the opposite way and the Constitution had been written differently, we would indeed have a different idea of what the Constitution correctly said. It's for this sort of reasoning that I think that judicial decisions are instinctively on a very different basis than textual legislation or constitution. So let's just take rather some simplistic assumption that there are on at least some occasions the decisions that might be called incorrect. For instance, for hypothetical, let's say maybe Marbury against Madison was decided incorrectly. This is sort of an interesting case in that it's the one that nobody ever seems at the Federalist Society to think actually was decided incorrectly. And we heard at the last panel that there were many people talking about the power of the courts not to bind the legislature, and the fact that when a judge decides a case, it only has authoritative impact with regard to the facts of the particular case, and because precedents don't have this kind of expansive impact, of course the executive isn't going to be bound. Well, how do they prove this? Well, they cite Marbury against Madison. This proves it, because they have a precedent that establishes this. So Marbury against Madison seems to have this unusual, magical flavor of being able to survive any criticism of the judiciary or of the system of precedent at all. Well, once you decide that there exists, in fact, the possibility of incorrect decisions, that really changes somewhat the nature of the question you're asking. Because once you decide this, then it seems at first blush to be very easy question. What ought a judge to do when he's faced with one of these incorrect decisions, assuming that he has, in fact, decided that the decision is incorrect? And there is a simple instinct when you're presented with one of those cases, and it's an instinct that I sympathize with very strongly, which is, well, once you've decided that the decision is incorrect, it really does seem immensely, immensely problematic to go ahead and apply it anyway. which is more important, the real meaning of the Constitution or some precedent that made its way into the law books. And I have, when I'm faced with a decision that I truly feel is incorrect this way, I have something of the same feeling as I did in the when I read the New York Times a couple weeks ago when I read the little announcement about what the Pope had decided about various forms of surrogate motherhood and birth control and whatnot. And I read this whole long, complicated list of things about what the Pope had decided that God really wanted. Somebody pointed out in the last session that there's an enormous resemblance between this problem of comparative religion and the problem of constitutional interpretation. You've got this authoritative interpreter, the Pope, but is he really saying the truth when he gives some kind of religious interpretation? And as I read this long discussion of how if I was infertile, it was all right for me to have sex, but it was not all right for me to have artificial insemination, I came away with a clear feeling of, who does this guy think he's kidding? I just don't believe that God says this. And when I read U.S. reports, I often have this feeling. In fact, you can push the resemblance a little further as I was reading this New York Times article, and it's got all this incredible detail about our uteruses and, you know, times of conception and all this stuff. Why does this seem so familiar? All of a sudden, I realize, my God, this is Roe against Wade again. On some level, I think this is what I really believe about precedent. When I read one of these outrageous opinions, and believe me, Roe against Wade cannot hold a candle to some of the choice of law decisions at the Supreme Court. This is my real interest. I'm not really interested in Roe against Wade. And I find myself outraged at these. I think that I actually do believe that it's very important for judges to be willing on at the drop of a hat to re-examine a decision that is clearly wrong. And one piece of evidence that I noticed that this really is my true belief is I write law review articles about these opinions. I write law review articles that criticize these opinions and point out how stupid they are and suggest in the most tactful way that I can, that at the very first opportunity, with all due deliberate speed, that the Supreme Court ought to do whatever it could to get rid of these decisions that I dislike so much. Now, I cannot really believe that I am asking the Supreme Court to do something immoral. Deep down, if I am willing to make these arguments in print that these decisions ought to be overruled, it must be because I believe that they would be doing the right thing. So, on one level, I think I do believe that it's important to re-examine precedent whenever it's necessary, whenever you're faced with something that is clearly a stupid decision. Now, on the other hand, because as I said, I see very good arguments on both sides of this, the problem is that the argument, if you really believe it, seems to go much too far. Because what this really is a problem about the relationship of truth to hierarchy. This is a problem that arises whenever you have some kind of, quote, truth, but you have a hierarchy that's involved in enforcing the truth. Because someone lower in the hierarchy, or later along in the system of stare decisis, is going to get in the position of having to decide, do I do what I think is true, or do I do the thing that I'm authoritatively supposed to do according to the institutional arrangements of which I am a part. Now, I want to give you two examples that show why I think it's so problematic to strictly go with the very sympathetic position that you do the thing that's true rather than the thing that is part of the institutional hierarchy. One of those was actually alluded to this morning by Judge Posner when he was discussing the now famous Edelson, or whatever the name of this insurance law appellate jurisdiction doctrine. Was he prefaced his remark after he said, this is the most moronic thing that I've ever seen, he says, well, but of course I applied it. Now, Why, of course, did he apply it? Well, I think part of what he was saying was that as an appellate judge subject to Supreme Court review, he felt that that was an additional reason for applying it. We have to keep in mind that stare decisis is not merely a matter of whether the Supreme Court follows what the Supreme Court did 5 or 10 years ago. We also have to decide whether this is something that we want appellate judges to follow, because they, too, are going to be faced with the problem of deciding, should I do the institutionally, authoritatively correct thing, or shall I do what I think is true? And there's one final example that I want to give, and I think this one is very problematic. It has to do with the executive branch. When I mention the executive branch, you probably think about the example that was given last in the last session about whether the executive branch should follow the court. That's not the example I have in mind. I'm talking about the hierarchy within the executive branch. There will be certainly the president has a role in enforcing the Constitution. Certainly the people operating underneath him play a part in that also. Is someone who is operating within the executive branch supposed to routinely, on a case-by-case basis, examine every decision that the president made and make up his or her own mind about whether this ought to be enforced? Well, we are I see my moderator inching towards me with his time's up sign. I hope, if anything, I can convince you that this is a very complicated problem. There's good arguments on both sides. It's not simply enough to say what Mr. Cooper says, which is these are idiotic decisions, they have to be overruled. You have to think about what this means in the entire context of the institutional hierarchy, and also perhaps in terms of what it means in terms of an original intent. Because what, after all, was the framers' attitude towards stare decisis? If the framers themselves had believed in stare decisis, then you can at least make the argument that this sort of slippage in the judicial process was built into the Constitution and protected in some way. I don't know enough history to know whether that's a plausible argument. I hope merely that it's something to think about.
Since Lee Bromeyer used only 10 of the 25 minutes she had allocated to herself, I figure that leaves me 40. So brace yourselves. Text and precedent are an old pair. They're so old it should frighten us that we don't yet have a theory of the interaction between the two. Precedent is a device by which cases may be called law rather than will, rules rather than results. And to have a theory of precedent is to have a theory of the extent to which judges' acts are law. And yet we don't have such a theory. Veteran judges such as Justice Cardozo could proclaim, as he did, that no theory is possible, that adherence to precedent is simply a matter of trial and error, that when adherence is too dissonant with other rules or too harmful because of the effects of the rules, we will then stop adhering. Well, there we have it, a grand balancing test with neither weights nor a unitary maximand. It is Winston Churchill's pudding without a theme. Now, precedent's important, though, for reasons other than a desire by judges that their decisions be treated as if they were law, or that likes be treated alike. And it's valuable for reasons real liberals should approve, because it's the way in which rules of law may arise or change without a central authoritative decider. The stock of precedents is produced by generations of judges wrestling with very hard questions. They study the problems and they record their conclusions, as traders of coal may study the properties of the coal and the demand for coal and make their bids. Like the price of coal, the system of precedent may incorporate more wisdom than any single trader or judge possesses. Precedent decentralizes decision-making and allows each judge to build on the wisdom of his predecessors. In a world where questions arise faster than the information necessary to supply the answers, it's an essential function. Precedent not only economizes on information, but also cuts down on idiosyncratic conclusions by subjecting each judge's work to the test of congruence with his peers. This increases both the chances of being right and the likelihood that similar cases arising contemporaneously will be treated similarly by different judges. Yet to express the role of precedent as one of economizing on information and of cutting down idiosyncrasies will also show why precedent will be unstable. Because although the system of precedent impounds information and wisdom greater than any judge can bring to bear, no particular precedent does so. Any given case may have been tossed off between Professor Moore's salads or based on a factual blunder, as was the Enloe-Edelson doctrine. And modern judges have, in principle, all the information available to their forebears, plus any discoveries in the interim, plus any new arguments that have been thought of in the interim, and the benefit of hindsight. Cases often are decided because of predictions about the consequences those cases will have. We can examine the effects. We can examine them both for their interaction with other strands of doctrine and for the influence of legal rules on the behavior that is sought to be regulated. So the possibility of improving on the treatment of an earlier case will make precedent unstable. It ought to be unstable, provided we can focus with sufficient clarity on single precedents where modern judges can make a realistic claim that their wisdom is as great as the collective wisdom embodied in a system of precedent. Now, precedent's under pressure from other sources as well, sources that will ensure continual evolution and occasional sharp breaks. One is simply the power of ex post claims. Precedents, that is, rules, are based in most cases on categorical predictions. They're an exercise in rule utilitarianism or in some other ethical system in which rules play some role. But any given case before a judge may seem to argue for an exception. Perhaps the rule may be subdivided. Perhaps a claim of an act utilitarian nature appears to countermand the rule. And perhaps there's a simple ex post claim for fair division of the stakes, given that everything that's going to happen has already happened, the future be damned. Those kinds of arguments appeal to many judges. And these, like all temptations, I suppose, are to be resisted by judges, but they won't always be. That will be a source of pressure on good rules. And sometimes the pressure will succeed, transmuting good rules into bad ones. It is, I think, the source of pressure by which rules, once clear, are turned into multi-factor balancing tests with two tiers, three prongs per tier, and four tines per prong. Those flabby cases ought to come under pressure by subsequent cases moving in the other direction. And of course, there will also be pressure because no one can identify how bad is bad enough. We can see the virtue of abandoning Plessy, Swift against Tyson, Lochner, and even Lowe against Austin, despite the fact that all of those cases had very long runs of acceptance. Lowe against Austin, for those of you who don't remember, was the original package doctrine of 1873. What it did was disable states from taxing goods that had moved in interstate and foreign commerce until they had been taken out of their boxes. Now, that led to all sorts of innovations in the warehousing industry and hundreds of doctrinal curlicues as states tried to get around a doctrine that was at best unprincipled and at worst idiotic. One day in 1976, the court overruled it in a case where no one had even briefed the issue because it occurred to them 103 years after it came down that it had done nothing but sow mischief. After it was overruled in 1976, everyone promptly forgot that the doctrine had ever existed. No one misses it, so far as I can tell. The idea that a doctrine has been around for a long time and has produced many sequelae is not a very good argument for keeping it. On the other hand, when one says bad doctrines can be got rid of when we finally see 103 years later that there was no point in it to begin with, is simply to raise a series of questions of degree on which it is impossible to have a theory generating an answer. How bad is bad enough? Do reliance interests counsel caution? Surely yes. How much reliance counsels how much caution? We have no way to reduce those questions to a common metric, and therefore no way in which to give an answer. There is, of course, the further problem that the alternative to disavowing a doctrine is to manipulate it. And again, we have no sound way other than the shared values of the legal culture to deal with that kind of manipulation. Manipulation is possible because no precedent constrains the selection of which factors in that precedent matter. Was Plessy a case about Jim Crow in general, or was it a case about blacks on trains? It could have been read broadly. It could have been read narrowly. Which features of a case matter will be influenced by subsequent developments in the whole legal culture, which will influence how we think of what it was in the precedent that mattered, that caused it to be decided that way. Then there's the problem of public choice. Kenneth Arrow showed that when institutions make decisions by majority vote, they will generate logically inconsistent results unless the voters have very similar orderings among their choices. Magic word is single-peakedness. I needn't pursue the details. Over many years, courts will leave behind precedents that, if not inconsistent, generate inconsistent implications. We've been told in tort law, for example, that physicians must, on pain of million-dollar liability, give elaborate warnings of the risk of their services. And the rationale for that is to protect the autonomy of patients to decide what treatment to receive, even if sometimes the risks will be frightening, the warnings will be frightening, and the patients with those warnings will decide against their self-interest. The value that is expressed in those cases is one of protecting the patient's autonomy. We have also been told that laws requiring physicians to give warnings about a particular medical service, abortion, are unconstitutional infringements on the autonomy of physicians. Apparently, and incongruously, because these warnings might affect the patient's choices. Faced with that tension, what is it that the system of precedent contains when a judge has another question about warnings, or about autonomy, or about abortion? Adherence to precedent in a system with built-in divisions, with built-in contradictions, increases the judge's power of decision, the opposite of the intended effect of a system of precedent. The judge may decide a case in the future about warnings, about autonomy, or about abortion, either way, by choosing which line of precedent on which to rely. He may justify his decision in the name of precedent, all the while hiding his instrumental reasons for the choice among lines of precedent. Only the overruling or the reconstruction of one of those lines of precedent can relieve that pressure and restore effective constraint on judges. The point, in other words, is the precedent can be liberating rather than constraining, and that a change of precedent might be necessary to produce constraint. The alternative to overruling is either a chaotic world in which choice among lines of precedent is itself unconstrained, or one in which we have a series of cases building on other cases in a rather chaotic way, much the way a rumor chain operates. You all remember the way a rumor chain operates. The first person tells the story to the second, tells the story to the third. Well, there's much in a system of precedent that makes it like a rumor chain. And where we come out of that rumor chain may be so dramatically different from where we went in that it is necessary to start at the beginning. There's another way in which precedent destabilizes a legal system. The way is path dependence. There's a formal proof, again in the theory of public choice, that somebody who has control of the order in which decisions will be taken can bring about a result that only he prefers, provided he can reduce each choice to a selection among two alternatives, with the majority winning at each stage and the losing alternative discarded in further discussions. The defeated choice is cast aside and never reemerges. Now, the technical proof of that is daunting. Let me give you a single example in the Supreme Court's cases. The abortion and privacy cases. Both deal with the abortion and the sodomy cases. Both of them deal with sexual privacy. Suppose you have the following sequence of decisions. First question, does the right of sexual privacy protect abortion? Second question, is the privacy interest at stake the same in an abortion case and in a sodomy case? Third question, does the right of sexual privacy protect consensual sodomy? Sequence is as follows. The abortion case is decided first by a vote of 7-2 in favor of holding that there is a right of sexual privacy pertaining to the abortion decision. The second case, we learn, as it turns out, in Bowers against Hardwick, that 8 of the 9 justices think that the abortion question and the sodomy question are constitutionally identical in terms of their analysis. And one would then think that in an ordered system of precedent, having found that there is a privacy interest sufficient to protect abortion, having learned that abortion and sodomy are identical, the conclusion is that the constitutional right of privacy protects sodomy. Reverse the decisions. Let us suppose first that the question is whether there is a constitutional right of privacy sufficient to protect sodomy. Answered, you can choose your numbers, 5-4, 7-2, no, there is no such right. Second question, is that the same question as abortion? Answered, 8-1, yes. And now the abortion decision arises and should be resolved consistent with those two principles, the opposite of the way it was in fact resolved. The order in which the cases arrives for decision then makes a fundamental difference in the set of constitutional principles the system contains. In the actual cases that came before the court, the link was broken. Justice Powell switched sides. He dishonored precedent. Instead, he purported to find a difference between those two cases. He put stare decisis to one side and therefore avoided the problem of path dependence in the legal system. And it seems to me that is entirely right. No sound system of legal rules has such fundamental questions depend not on the text, not on intent, not on the nature of society or any other line of argument, but solely on the order in which cases arise for decision. But stare decisis, rigidly followed, could do exactly that. Well, when Mr. Kinsley wrote me his letter to which he referred, he asked me if I would write something about stare decisis in the New Republic, and I sent back a letter which said, gee, I would be delighted to write about stare decisis in the New Republic or any place else if I knew anything about stare decisis. But not only do I not know anything about stare decisis, I don't know anybody else who knows anything about stare decisis, and so I regret that I can't suggest who you should contact next. I trust I have proved my first claim. The position I would like to leave you with is that stare decisis can be both a stabilizing, information-conserving system and a destabilizing system in a system of legal rules. Where Cardozo left the subject in 1921 was inability to state when the stabilizing and destabilizing tendencies should lead to following and not following precedent. I find myself in much the same position as Cardozo, but we shall be unable to talk intelligently about precedent until we recognize both the stabilizing and destabilizing roles and take these roles into account in deciding when to follow and when to disregard existing decisions of the court. Thank you.
Well, as the last speaker of the day, I appear before you with considerable trepidation, not only because you have heard a lot of speeches, but because before I came, I read a statement made by one of my colleagues on the Ninth Circuit, which, according to the article passed out to you today, right place at the right time, the Federalist Society article, which says that you clapped thunderously as my colleague, Justice Noonan, a recent Reagan appointee to the United States Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit, booms in righteous indignation, the enemy is canting empty-headed, mealy-mouthed liberalism. Well, I will try not to be empty-headed or mealy-mouthed, but I guess I am the enemy, at least according to my colleague, Justice Noonan, because I stand here today as a liberal judge. And it may take me a little time to try to explain to you what I think the answer to this question is. But I came a long way from California, and I've listened for 9 hours of discussion. And I'll try to get within 15 minutes. But I do have a few comments I would like to make. I don't condemn all conservatives. Nor do I believe all conservatives have disrespect for the law, only some. The political attack on the role of law in the courts engaged in by the Justice Department is not only unseemly, but nothing new. Whether it is that the executive branch is above the law or that the Supreme Court should have no respect for precedent, the message is and has been consistent. It is not too surprising that there is little mention of justice by the representatives of the Justice Department. It is surprising that there is respect neither for law nor order. But it's not my place, as I said, to judge any or all conservatives today or to fulfill Mr. Cooper's prophecy that liberals tell conservatives to obey the law. Rather, I'll try to tell you how I, as a liberal, try to apply the law and how I try to answer the question of the conflict between text and precedent in constitutional adjudication. The basic question is, how do we determine whether there is a conflict? Must it be a conflict with the text, or is a conflict with the intent of the drafters enough? Next, how certain should a judge be of the true meaning before he votes to override precedent? The topic raises all the issues inherent in the question, how should a judge reach decisions? Hard as it may be to accept, there are no absolutist answers to these or almost any other questions in the law. I agree with, not surprisingly, one of the members of the last panel, that there are frequently several plausible and potentially correct answers. Most often, there is no necessary answer. The basic questions posed today and the basic questions we face as judges are steeped in uncertainty. All require judgment, application of philosophy, values, yes, balancing, and all require a sense of justice, too often lacking. The fact that there may be a choice among plausible answers makes law no less important a tool, and compliance with the law, including judicial decisions, no less essential. We can't leave it to each president and each individual to decide which parts of the law he will obey. We had a president who thought he was above the law and was not required to obey the law. I thought that question was answered. I think it must be answered in the affirmative if there is any doubt. To me, that's what the legal system is about. That's what the Constitution is about. Respect for law, respect for justice, respect for order. And that applies to all of us, presidents, judges, congressmen. If the congressman can disobey the law, the president can disobey the law, I suppose I am also free as a judge to ignore the Supreme Court. Sometimes it may seem to some of you as if we do that. We don't do it deliberately. We may have legitimate disagreements. But all judges I know, conservatives and liberals, try to follow the law as they understand it. We may have some disagreements on how we reach our decisions, but I don't know any judge personally, or anyone I've had contact with, who doesn't believe it's his duty to follow, obey, and apply the law. And I don't think we're any different from anyone else in this country. Now, whether you obtain your meaning of the Constitution by limiting your examination to what you believe a number of individuals thought 200 years ago, whether you believe this is discoverable natural law waiting for you to come along and reveal it, or whether you believe you should look for basic concepts and apply them to society's changing circumstances of justice in light of society's changing values, we're still only talking about selecting techniques. No particular technique leads to a necessary result when we decide legal problems. One can read the literal words of the Constitution and find oneself faced with two equally plausible interpretations. So, too, we can look at the legislative history, or we can look at the words of the founders and not know the answer with any certainty. That leaves us with two choices. Either, if there is no certainty and there are several choices, everyone will decide for himself what laws to follow, what decisions to follow, or everyone will obey the law of the land as it is decided by the courts. To me, as a liberal, the answer is clear. We obey the law of the courts, whether I agree with the Supreme Court or not. In short, most often the fundamental philosophy as to the role of government and the rights of the individual dictate the conclusions judges reach rather than the process. The process is important. Technique is important. Unfortunately, none of these questions are as simple as they appear. We don't just read the language of the Constitution and ignore the words of the founders. We don't just read the words of the founders and ignore the language of the Constitution. We don't just read either and ignore the cases that the Supreme Court's decided. Judging is a complex matter, and we look at all of those factors. Now, that brings us to the unfortunate situation that we need to apply our intelligence, our judgment as judges, to those difficult problems. Fortunately, we are not janitors. Fortunately, we have been selected to attempt to use the best legal reasoning and the best legal process possible to arrive at what we believe to be the correct answers. That's the best we can do in a system of law and justice. Now let's consider a specific question. Was there a conflict between the 14th Amendment and Plessy versus Ferguson? Some would say yes, some would say no, even today. Does Brown versus Board of Education conflict with the intent of the drafters of the 14th Amendment? Again, we can probably find legitimate disagreement on that question. Almost never, if ever, is there a conflict between the plain, unambiguous, literal language of the Constitution and precedent. If it were all that clear in the literal language, the judges, the justices, would follow this and would follow the plain meaning. Now, let me just say here, in this discussion, I am really talking about the role of the justices rather than the role of the appellate court. Because like Judge Easterbrook's court, we are not free to overrule our own precedent or the precedent of another panel. Only an embanked court can do that. But in discussing when precedent should be followed, our answer is clear, we follow it. The real issue is when should the Supreme Court overrule precedent? In any event, almost never, as I said, is there a conflict with the plain meaning of the language, at least not one that's apparent to most people. But there may still be a conflict. There may be a conflict with the Constitution, the meaning of that constitutional language, even if it's not apparent just from a literal, simple reading of the Constitution. Well, what do we do when we think that there may be? How do we decide whether there is, in fact, a conflict between the meaning of the Constitution and precedent? Well, as I said, there are various techniques, but none leads to a necessary answer. Part of the problem is our reluctance to acknowledge what we do when we make choices. A good example is found in three cases decided in one decade by the United States Supreme Court. First, in Logan Valley. In 1968, the court said in Logan Valley that there was a free speech right to picket in shopping centers during a labor dispute. In 1972, in Lloyd versus Tanner, the court said that Vietnam protesters were different. They were not allowed to picket in shopping centers. In 1979, in Hudgens, the court said there's no difference between labor speech and political speech. Therefore, the picketing permitted in Logan Valley must be prohibited under Lloyd, and the court overruled Logan in the name of respecting Lloyd precedent, although Lloyd expressly said it was not overruling Logan. Well, there, I think a legitimate criticism may be offered of the Supreme Court's technique. There is a deception in the way they arrived at the result. And there's too little honesty in all of our opinions as to how we reach our conclusions. A simple example, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone else. When you finish reading one of our opinions, you think, you may disagree, but you would think that at least the judge thought there wasn't the least possible question of the answer. The arguments are so persuasive, at least to the author. It seems quite simple. All the arguments are on one side. We ought to more frequently acknowledge that there is real doubt as to the outcome, and to acknowledge in the opinion some of the doubts we have and acknowledge some of the choices we have made along the line. Because there are hidden choices in every decision that are not revealed, but that are difficult, complex choices that we make and that would take us down different roads. Now, in making those choices, I would have to say that every judge I have ever seen is influenced by his fundamental philosophy of law and of life, by stare decisis, by the changes that have occurred in society, by his view of his role and his view of the legal system. Those are personal subjective choices, but they all fit within an orderly process of reasoning. We have a longing for simplistic answers, for the return to a simple society, to a day when law was law and men were white males. It would be nice if we could fit all of our problems into little pigeonholes, if we could all become janitors who need do little but push a button and obtain the right answer from a machine. But most problems that concern the public do not have simplistic solutions, and they require judges to judge, judges to exercise judgment, judges to do their best to understand what the law is. Our basic legal principles are ordinarily stated quite broadly. Various interpretations and justifications can legitimately be drawn. Precedent usually exists on both sides. The primary arguments we have today reflect long-standing, differing views of the law, both procedural and substantive. Sometimes one view prevailed in the past, sometimes another. Therefore, there are numerous cases adopting the principal views that we can find in the books and rely on. As judges, we can find precedent for almost everything, and in many cases, we can find precedent for both sides of the argument that we hear. That requires our judgment. Now, when a justice has decided, through whatever complex reasoning he follows, that under his view of the meaning of the Constitution, a precedent conflicts with that document, or to put it differently, that he believes that the last group of justices to consider the issue was wrong, when should he vote to overrule precedent? Here, I think I agree in part with Judge Easterbrook, though I'm not certain. I know he does not like balancing, but he said there is no answer. There are a number of factors to consider. I agree basically with those factors. I don't think we can do it by applying the law of economics. I don't think it's a statistical argument. I don't think it's a cost-benefit analysis. But I think there are factors that we must apply. How sure is the justice that he is right? How well established is the, quote, erroneous precedent? How wrong does he believe that precedent is? How important are the rights involved, according to his view of the essence of the Constitution? How disruptive will the change be? How likely is a reversal to last and be stable? See Justice Rehnquist's dissent in Garcia, in which he says the next time they get an appointment, they'll reverse the precedent again. Is there a principled way to limit rather than overrule a precedent? Is that what Justice Powell did in Hardwick? Now, you take all those factors and add them up, and there are no mechanics, there are no mathematics. You make a judgment. I will try to abbreviate the last 2 or 3 minutes. What I wish we could do to make it possible for those who need to have more respect for law and order and for judicial decisions than exists in the government and elsewhere today is to strip the masks, remove the mysteries, eliminate the rationalizations, expose the myriad of choices, and make people understand that law is complex, that judges are generally honest, decent people. The judges do apply their personal philosophies, and that's why the people who have been appointed since this administration is in office have one philosophy. And that's why some of the people appointed in the past administration have another. Unfortunately, the last administration didn't have an attorney general who was as committed to a philosophy of law as a present attorney general. And I have no criticism of the present attorney general for that kind of commitment. I wish some of the past ones had had it too. To end with the specific, if basic human rights are involved, there is far more reason to overrule precedent than in other cases. Now, that reflects my view of what the Constitution stands for. Our understanding of fundamental rights changes as society progresses. We no longer put people in stocks or stone them, although we still have capital punishment. If the Constitution expresses a set of principles, as I believe it does, then its interpretation must change with the times. In my opinion, historicists, or some call interpretists or interpretivists, everyone interprets, but historicists do an injustice to the Constitution if they seek to freeze it so that it applies only to specific implementations contemplated 200 years ago. But I won't get into that debate here. But if at the time of Plessy we thought separate but equal was all right, it was because it was a specific view of at least some framers of the 14th Amendment. Was it their general view as well? Well, that's the issue you heard earlier. But more important than finding, and each side can find an argument as to whether Plessy should have been overruled, but more important, by the time Brown versus Education was decided, society knew better. And therefore, the court was right when it overruled an erroneous precedent. It was a fundamental decision that was erroneous and adversely affected basic rights and was contrary to the essence of our Constitution. To me, the Constitution is not a cold, not a bloodless document. This country and our Constitution stand for far more than freedom of contract, far more than Adam Smith's economics. It stands for a government that will promote the general welfare and for the rights of individuals to be free from arbitrary governmental actions. It stands for a just society and for justice. And when we make our decisions, when we decide whether to overrule what we think is erroneous precedent, and I say we as if I were on the Supreme Court, but when the Supreme Court does that, those are the factors I believe that the justices should look at. And unfortunately, there is no simple answer. Sometimes precedent should be overruled, sometimes it shouldn't, and there's no mechanical answer. You must weigh those factors. Unfortunately, we may not agree on the factors. Some of us might have some different considerations, but whoever is on the court must take precedent seriously, must apply the factors, and do his best to try to implement what he believes, in light of history, in light of the text, in light of precedent, to be the real meaning of the Constitution.
We don't have a lot of time left. Everyone's going to get a chance to talk for a couple more minutes. I just want to ask Chuck Cooper, just to get this rolling, about if he could address himself to a point that I think Judge Reinhardt and Judge Easterbrook both made in slightly different ways, which is, it seems quite obvious that if the Supreme Court has done something completely stupid and everybody on the current Supreme Court agrees about that, that they should overrule it. I guess if you had to put in a nutshell this point, it would be a question of humility. Is it, in most circumstances, it's not all that certain to people what the proper result is. And even if it is certain to them, shouldn't they have a grain of doubt in their minds that, after all, if at least five of the nine justices were wrong in the past, they could be wrong themselves? And shouldn't this kind of humility, this kind of sense of uncertainty, and it's also a sense, as Judge Easterbrook put it, of the institution being more important than any individual justice, play some role to give them some reluctance about simply overturning a precedent because they happen to think it was wrong?
Michael, I think you put it well when you characterize it as a sense of humility or perhaps judicial modesty. I certainly concede that if the judge cannot conclude that he is persuaded, he or she is persuaded that the precedent is an error, it is entirely appropriate to defer to the decisions decision that has been made. And the, but that to me is a sense of modesty. Once the judge has persuaded him or herself that the decision was in error, and you know there I candidly confess there are degrees of persuasion, but if one concludes the decision was an error, I think fidelity to the law and fidelity to the lawmaker, and in essence to the in our system anyway, to the notion of consent by the governed, about which we heard some this morning from Mike McConnell, requires that he. That he overruled the decision.
Should the degree of certainty be higher if there is a precedent than if this is a new question on which the court has never ruled before?
No. Well, if there is a precedent, one has reasoning to survey and to apply his own intellectual faculties to, but without having to reinvent the wheel entirely, although in my opinion
you're happy to do it. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that that one is essentially bound to do it if a challenge has been made to the reasoning, which it essentially was the point I concluded on. If a challenge has been made to the reasoning of a case, I think the reasoning should be tested, and if it survives the rigors of reexamination, certainly it should be adhered to. If one cannot conclude that it is wrong, I think it has survived the rigor of reexamination.
Well, with regard to the degree of persuasion, I first want to emphasize the distinction between the horizontal and the vertical reaches of precedent, which a distinction which we keep blurring, and I think they're quite different. The reach of the authority of the court to reexamine its own precedent is quite different from the authority of an inferior court to do the same, and let me come back to that. First off, with regard to the reach of precedent horizontally, and we're talking about constitutional precedent, I remind you that both Justices Brennan and Marshall have consistently filed a vote in every death penalty case that they view the death penalty as unconstitutional, and that's an automatic two votes for a stay in every death penalty case going up, although the court has, quote, authoritatively spoken on that basic issue that it is constitutional, because their vote is, and it's the same each time, that in all circumstances, in any circumstances, the death penalty is unconstitutional. So I think that's a pretty good signal with regard to the justices' view of their own precedent and their whether or not they must abide the majority force once it has been decided. Now, how you reconcile that with the treatment of Weber, I leave to you. That's a quite different dimension when one is talking about the matter horizontally, because also there are quite distinct interests that are involved. Once one turns vertically, then other institutional concerns are very important, not the least of which are orderliness. Now, an inferior court judge, it seems to me, still has the latitude to read that precedent within the limits of what I think there is of stare decisis. And while, of course, we can't define it scientifically, there is a point of intellectual honesty with regard to some decisions. We know it. The fact of the matter is that there's sometimes we look at it, there's simply no way around it, and we abide it, although you don't like it. If you disagree with it, disagree in the sense that you believe that they have misread text, and you cannot, within the authority given to you to read precedent, which is considerable, then you have a choice. You either abide it or you resign as an inferior court justice. But that's quite different than looking at it horizontally. In which event, if viewed horizontally, it seems to me the justices ought to, when persuaded that they're wrong, to reconsider. And considering whether they're wrong or not, the level of persuasion must consider what's gone on before. And if they think, regardless of what's gone on before, the Constitution is the contrary, it seems to me their oath says they turn it back.
Professor Brillmeyer.
Well, I would like to cede my 3 minutes in the interest of getting to the cocktail party.
Uh, I trust Professor Brellmeyer will give me her cocktail as well as her 3 minutes. One point about the question of how confident someone should be before he votes to overrule something. The point I had been making about the one stability interest in a system of precedent is that it collects contributions of many people, each of whom has given a great deal of study to something. That suggests some difference in the way in which you think about overruling a precedent if a precedent can be picked out as itself a sore thumb in the law, and if the nature of the overruling would call into question a very large body of precedent which has been contributed to and worked on for a much longer period. In a case in which the attack is being made on a single reading of a statute, which is not embedded in a very strong set of doctrines, there seems to me no particular reason why you should demand a higher than ordinary degree of confidence. To the extent there is a higher than ordinary degree of confidence there, it is simply that you have the benefit of hindsight, something that your predecessors lacked, and you have everything else they had, and you can make your own decision accordingly. If the question, however, were something like, should we suddenly say now, 120 years after Ball against the United States was decided, the first important double jeopardy case, that in fact the double jeopardy clause picks up the English system of double jeopardy, so that any time a conviction is reversed on grounds other than jurisdictional, the defendant may not be retried. That's the English system. Should we say that our double jeopardy clause really picks up the British system of former acquittal and former conviction? One would have to be exceptionally confident that you understood not only the genesis of the double jeopardy clause, but all the consequences of making that move, because that's a body of doctrine that's been elaborated on for a very extended period and has not proved to be terribly unsatisfactory in outcome. You would naturally, in dealing with such a body of doctrine, demand of yourself a substantially greater degree of study and confidence than you would in dealing with a single-shot decision on a particular statute that does not appear to affect or come from much broader study and much broader documents.
Could I just add, I certainly don't have any disagreement with that analysis. I think it essentially boils down to, however, it may well be that in undertaking the reexamination, you have to do a whole heck of a lot more work, and I don't regard that as problematic.
Well, the other observation is that we're talking principally about the practice of overturning precedent. I suggest to you that the law turns more often than not by the Supreme Court by simply cutting precedent back to an irrelevant state, by stripping the legs from it, by narrowing precedent and not expressly overruling it. The books are full of that, and so they never really come quite to grips with that, and the stare decisis has allowed them to do that.
Like Logan Valley.
Yes.
All right. Well, I thought we had a nice clear disagreement after Mr. Cooper's first rebuttal, and my notes of what he said were, if a judge cannot conclude the precedent is an error, he should not vote to overrule it. Well, of course. Who would vote to overrule it if he thought it was right? But that was the only limitation Mr. Cooper advanced. So that, as I understood his response, it was, if the judge thinks it's wrong, then he should vote to overrule. Now he added, well, he may have to do a lot of work to read a precedent, if there is one, because then he'll have to look at that reasoning and decide it's wrong. But as I still think I understand his position, there is no role for precedent, other than a document for a judge to read the way he would read a brief to see what the legal reasoning is. Now, if that's the position of Mr. Cooper or the Justice Department, I am in disagreement with it, and I am in agreement with Judge Easterbrook's position, I think, at least in terms that there are factors. We give weight to precedent, and we must look at the types of case. Take Judge Higginbotham's example, Justice Brennan and Marshall's votes on the death penalty. Well, they probably, those votes probably, would meet the test that I offered, the factors. Is it a fundamental right Are you persuaded totally that it is correct? How important is it? What will if all of those factors, I would suspect, they consider and decide that is the type of precedent they would overrule. That doesn't mean they would overrule every type of precedent. And we have to. We have to arrive at a set of factors. Maybe not each have the same factors, but we have to decide which precedent we overrule, which we don't. I wish there were an absolute answer. We either overrule precedent willy-nilly, as Mr. Cooper suggests, or we never overrule it, as some might suggest. I don't think liberals or conservatives can give that answer to the question.
Or we overrule it when we want to, and basically that, I think, is the essential test that we've been offering.
Okay, we have time for about two profound but terse questions.
My name is Howard Haas. Judge Reinhardt mentioned Garcia and the Rehnquist opinion as if it was somehow out of line. Now, of course, it was Justice Blackmun who was a deciding opinion in that case overturning National League of Cities on essentially the same facts, and did so because he changed his mind. Mealy mouth, perhaps. But my question is directed towards Mr. Cooper and Judge Higginbotham, and that is, if National League of Cities is brought back, as I think many of us would like it to be, what does that say about stare decisis and the rule of law and judicial restraint? I mean, in terms of the revolving door in and out of the state's rights.
What does it say other than it's already been said?
Well, I mean, does the whole process look foolish is what I'm asking.
Well, I guess you better answer that one, Chuck.
What was that point? Does the process look foolish if the Supreme Court reverses itself twice within a decade?
Well, certainly it does tend
to... you're willing to look foolish in order to get a result you prefer, or you're willing for the institution?
Of course not. What I'm willing to see, however, is that event occur if it is necessary to get the correct decision. The correct decision in terms of the intent of the lawmaker. My view is that one would have to go back considerably farther than National League of Cities. However, if one were to accomplish the constitutional mandate in the area of the 10th Amendment and the limits of the Commerce Clause and what have you.
Gives us all something to look forward to. One last question.
My name is Clifford Bates, and I have a question to any of the panelists. Concerning very constitutional controversial issues that are touching us today, like abortion and affirmative action, should the Supreme Court opt not to decide and allow the states to decide on these issues, and allowing a greater amount of freedom of choice, allowing each state to individually decide which act they prefer?
I can answer that, no.
All right, well, I'll answer that, yes. And I'll do it.
There's a split in the circuits on this one.
And I want to go to the cocktail party.
But I'll do it for a reason. The reason is exactly the reason that Judge Reinhardt and Professor Newborn of the last panel gave. That is, when it is possible to describe a constitutional issue as being open-ended, as not having a right answer, as being difficult to pin down, as having a range of admissible answers, you have given a reason why the court cannot demand to have a single absolute answer and to be obeyed. You have, in other words, defeated the argument for judicial review in Marbury against Madison. Marbury was based on the proposition that there were right answers. When you deny Chief Justice Marshall's premise in Marbury, you have denied the power of judges to have the last word.
Okay. Well, Judge Easterbrook doesn't get quite the last word here. I think, I don't know about anybody else, but after I heard about Chuck Cooper's designs on the 10th Amendment, I certainly need a drink. But before I get one, Janice Calabresi has a couple of announcements.